Pseudopod episode 141, May 8th, 2009. This week's stories, well, something a little different. Welcome to Pseudopod Towers and the first installment of Flash on the Borderlands. Mention the man in black on one side of the Atlantic and people will undoubtedly and deservedly think of John Cash. Mention it on my side though, and there's a reasonable chance people will think of men like Valentine Dial, Edward D'Souza, and Mark Gatiss. All three have played a figure who, like the Shadow, has existed down through the decades on BBC Radio 4. The host of Fear on 4, an anthology of half-hour horror radio plays, the Man in Black is a laconic figure, with a fine line in dark humour and an appreciation for the macabre. It's very difficult not to think of him, as I sit here in Pseudopod Towers, and whilst I'm not fit to lace the man's immaculately tailored and deep, deep black shoes, we're going to be walking in his footsteps from time to time. Three stories. Three brief looks into three different types of darkness, presented in one episode. Three voices in the night, all clamouring for your attention. First up, we have a story of social awkwardness and literal body horror. This is easily one of the most extreme pieces we've run, so if you're not a gorehound or have problems with body horror, I strongly suggest skipping ahead. Jordan, when are you going to settle down, get married, and have us some children? Comes to us from JR and deals with two things everyone will have to do. Talk to the opposite sex, and, well, I'll let JR explain the other one.
Jordan, when are you going to settle down, get married, and have us some children? By JR. Beth, my most recent girlfriend, said I looked like a hanged man when I walk because I always stare down at my feet. She says it looks like there's an invisible noose around my neck, extending up to the moon. She always wanted to know why that was. The moon part makes me think she stole it from some movie, but I don't have any proof of that. But I gotta admit, the metaphor fits. I liked her. My head always stays down, but if there was any reason to lift it up, it would have been her. Our relationship, like all my relationships, died in the larval stage. We were only 3 months in. I'm old enough to have learned to cherish the newness of a relationship, when your lover's little tics are cute instead of grating, when seeing her every weekend is comforting, not quotidian. But then again, I never had the chance to let a relationship turn boring and routine, never had the chance to smother numinous lust with excessive doting, never had the chance to live out the tired passive-aggressiveness that characterizes all relationships in HBO movies about failed marriages. But I wish I could. I've even thought out a pithy little slogan for it. The luxury to be uxorious. I never got that far in a relationship, but still, I must have gotten too comfortable with Beth, because I let her hang out in my apartment with me even though I knew, God, I knew, that my bathroom sink was broken. There was no water pressure. It came out in an anemic trickle, weak and scattershot, like a skinny finger plugging a fat hole. It's funny, I knew I was assuming a risk, but still, I let it happen. Maybe it's my own little way of making sure I'll never be happy. I foresaw the end of the relationship immediately after I recognized the desperate gurgle in my stomach. My stomach lurched and sunk like a plummeting, fiery freight elevator. I couldn't stop it, but God, I desperately wish I could have. I didn't know what to do. It was a toxic toxin. I bounded to my feet, but instead of running into the bathroom like any normal person, I just stood up and did an awkward two-step. Like I was mulling it over, whether I really needed to shit my brains out, or just, you know, pace around a bit, get a little impromptu exercise, try out a new fidgety dance routine. "You all right there, killer?" she said. "Yeah, I'm good." I scoured my brain for some plausible excuse to get her to leave the apartment and wait outside. God, I'm not demanding. I wasn't looking for some irrefragable reason to get her to leave, some proposition beyond dispute. I just needed to think of something. But my guts had no sympathy for idlers. If I wasn't going to go to the bathroom, then the bathroom was coming to the common room. I was already running the risk of a gas leak. Susurration is a romantic word, but not so much when it's coming out of your ass. I power-walked to the bathroom without saying a word. I closed and locked the door. I would have fucking deadbolted it if I could. I instinctively turned on the faucet even though I knew it wouldn't work. Nothing but a silent trickle. That certainly didn't help anybody. I heard a muffled, "Are you okay?" from the common room. She must have heard me pacing and bouncing in place, my meager attempt to quell the foaming in my stomach and give me some time to think, for God's sakes, but it was all for naught, because a nagging little voice, the voice of futility, derailed my scheming. "I want to bottle her soft, caring voice," the voice of futility said, "and preserve it for safekeeping, so I can have something of her to remember." I opened my mouth to say something, but the ebullition in my stomach commanded my attention. I ran to the toilet. Beth, can I meet you? Can you wait outside? I don't know if that's what I said exactly, but it backfired. My timbre was too desperate, too hopeless, because I sensed her playing the role of the dutiful girlfriend and coming to the bathroom door. "Jordan, is everything all right in there?" "I'm fine. Can you wait outside?" I tucked my finger under the tape recorder I keep hidden behind my toilet, thinking that maybe I could turn it on and play the sounds of heavy running water like I always did. Yeah, I thought, yeah, it might work. I can play the tape, and maybe she'll forget the sink isn't working, and even if she does remember, it'll be easier to explain the sound of running water than... But that was just a stupid hope I'd never realize. Out it came, and for a brief, hallucinatory moment, I thought everything would be okay. It came out hot, in shoots, in spasms, reckless and unformed, like amped-up arterial spray. For some reason, I thought of Contra, and the gun that shot out a fan of evenly spaced bullets, all in different directions. It was like that, but thankfully in liquid form. More thankfully, it had gone without a hitch. My asshole felt raw, like usual, but the pain meant nothing considering the relief I felt. I grabbed the toilet paper and held it to my chest like a loved teddy bear, thrilled at the thought of just wiping my ass, flushing, washing my hands, and exiting the bathroom like every other normal person on planet Earth. God, even today, I fantasize what it must be like to just wipe your ass like any normal person. I picture it's like wiping through creamy nougat. This could be the day, I thought. I rested my head in my hand like the thinking man, ebullient about my new predicament, how to explain to Beth why I cried tears of joy after taking a shit. I was never so happy to put my hand on the flush lever. I thought of another pithy saying, "It flushes down, Beth sticks around." But no, that's just a stupid dream that I'd never realize. Just as earthquakes have aftershocks, so do bowel movements. Everyone knows that, but it's easy to forget. Well, for most people, it's a facet of a bodily function too inconsequential to really devote too much brain power to. Certainly not important enough to base your life around. But alas, the strategic mind and the capricious gut have proven irreconcilable. I offered a peace treaty between the two, but the parties are inconsolable. The parts could care less, and now the whole suffers. Out it came, discreet and guillotined in half, but this one came out solid, fully formed. I could just imagine its crusty face slowly descending into the water. The sooner the better. Then it would at least stop screaming for a second, its face or whatever filling with water, with the innards of its kith, until it could turn itself over and resume its mad panic. And God, this one was loud.
"Jesus, Jordan, what the fuck is that? Are you all right?"
I heard her banging on the door. Now I had to turn and look. I always have to. It was shaking, the one that came out solid, looking around, likely trying to gain some understanding of the glistening red and deep browns, floating limbs and heads and eyes surrounding it. It pushed its hand through the floating graveyard, getting lost in the liquid congeries. But even if I couldn't see it under its brothers and sisters, I could certainly hear it.
"Jesus, Jordan, what the fuck is going on in there? What the fuck? Are you okay? Don't do it, please!"
She must have thought I was committing suicide or something. I looked down at him. Yes, a him. This one was whole enough to tell the sex, unlike his melted siblings. I later looked up a unique word to describe their condition. I feel like everyday words don't do it justice, don't fully capture the alien otherness of the whole affair. They were his deliquest kin. It looked up at me with uncomprehending eyes, looking like a decomposing raisin, shrieking like a supernatural facsimile of its natural counterpart and smelling like you can imagine. It stretched out at me with a collapsing limb, trying to push itself like an otter away from the damned wreckage, its shrieking changing to burbling when it capsized itself while trying to avoid the eye that floated on its face. I hesitated, like I always do.
"Jordan, what the fuck?"
I flushed. Its arms broke off in chunks when it tried to wedge them against the hull. It cried all the way down. It looked just like me, just like they always do.
I'm a child of the 80s, which goes a very long way to explaining both my fondness for The Cure and my deep abiding love for war games and Professor Stephen Falcon in particular. The apocalypse was part of the landscape in the 80s, whether it was the belief the sun had a dark twin called Nemesis, the poles would shift suddenly and catastrophically, Nostradamus would actually be proved right about anything, ever, or someone would actually start World War III. There was a bright side though, the fact that we had a 3-minute warning meant that we could at least boil an egg before the missiles fell. Mike Batista's thinking about polar bears explores a very different, but no less intimate, type of disaster. It's narrated by our own Matt Arnold, and it's a story about what happens to one man once the world ends around him.
Thinking About Polar Bears by Mike Batista. I wake up exhausted. I hadn't slept well. My heart still beats quickly. The aftermath of vaguely remembered dreams. I close my eyes. Images rush into my consciousness without warning. I see a dog with its teeth bared. I see raw, bloody meat spread across a white floor in elastic strings. In the distance, deep in my unconscious, I hear a bell ringing. I open my eyes and go into the kitchen. My heart continues to pump as if I'm being attacked. Fight or flight. I prepare myself the usual breakfast, a bowl of Cheerios, a quarter cup of milk. In my mind, I see boulders hurtling through a darkened sky. I see blood pouring from under the doors of a destroyed house. I try to watch television, but I have no concentration. Every time I blink, new horrors flash before my closed eyes. I try to think about something else. I attempt the old memory trick. Do not think about polar bears. Usually, you try to avoid thinking about polar bears. All you can think about are polar bears. This time, all I see are dead people, frozen in ice, the tips of their noses purple-black. I see the flesh on a man's face being shredded by a raging storm of jagged hail. I get on my leather coat. I see dead deer, bloated maggots wriggling in their eye sockets. Nearby, I see a scrawny wolf ripping and tearing at a decaying severed leg. I get on the elevator, and it shakes slightly before moving. I see the earth splitting open, spewing lava across neatly mowed grass. I see buildings collapsing in colossal plumes of smoke, September 11th multiplied by 100. When I get outside, I see that it's not just me. The building superintendent has a bag and a stick with him. When he goes to impale a piece of trash from the gutter, the stick stops in midair as he closes his eyes and grimaces in pain. A moment later, he shakes his head and picks up the trash, begins to walk to the next piece, but stops mid-step and grunts at an image only he can see. I see bodies lining the streets. I see gutters flowing with blood, a chunky film floating on top. It's warm and sunny outside, but I feel a chill in the air. I see trees of black, brown roses too. I see skies of red, clouds of ash. I begin to walk. People differ in their reactions. Some shuffle with their heads down and their eyes closed, muttering to themselves. Others walk with their faces to the sky, eyes wide open, mouths agape, but silent. A homeless man is wandering in the middle of the street, laughing maniacally. In my mind, I see a pack of dogs ripping him apart. Then, in unison, the pack turns its hungry eyes on me. At the grocery store, a man is crying as he loads a dozen packages of bottled water, some boxes of canned food, and 4 flashlights into his minivan. I see a little girl huddling around a flashlight, shivering between her parents, both dead, their faces covered in ice. I see the flashlight get dimmer, 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 then black, then silence. I arrive at the office. I take the cell phone out of my pocket. No signal. I turn on my computer, and already there are emails from my mom, from my brother, who I haven't heard a word from in 2 years, from my ex-wife. I close my eyes and I see electrons and atoms and molecules whipping around in the infinity of space, colliding with each other in brilliant flashes of light. I see space and time twisting and turning and folding back on themselves. Outside, it's darker than it was when I woke up, but there's not a cloud in the sky. I get up and wander the halls. The guy in the office next to mine, Ivan, he's not there. Neither is his dog. He always brings his dog to work. As I walk, my footsteps echo down the empty halls, and I see bare feet crunching on fresh snow. I can almost feel the sharp chill in my own toes. I go to the staff lounge, and my coworkers are standing around the television in the corner, staring up at it with worried, tear-streaked faces. I see a large city from a distance. The buildings have exotic, decorative roofs, so they're probably not American. The sky above the city is red. There is a large, round object in that sky. It takes up most of the field of view, and it descends rapidly. This last vision I see with my eyes open. It's on the television screen. Ivan is here. His mouth is open. For some reason, I ask him where his dog is today. He does not answer. On the screen, I see a diagram of the solar system with a line representing the orbit of the Earth. The circle representing Earth flashes, and then it leaves the line and starts a new orbit a few inches further from the sun. Someone turns a light on. Outside the window, it looks like night. The television goes back to the camera in the foreign city. The object in the sky, it's gray, it's massive, it's descending quickly. People are running past the cameraman, but he stays put, keeps filming, and I can hear him weeping. The object reaches the skyline, then the screen goes gray for a moment. Then there is static. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I don't feel fine. I'm going to vomit. I leave the lounge and begin to walk down the hallway. My heart is beating faster than it ever has before. I want to run, to fight, to pass out, but no action would serve a purpose. I see blood and destroyed cities and night and ice in that order. I arrive at the bathroom and I see Ivan's dog. There's piss and shit on the white floor. Ivan must have locked the poor panicking thing in the bathroom so he could watch the news in peace. I go to pet the poor thing. He latches onto my hand with his teeth. Blood is splashing onto the white floor. This works better than avoiding thoughts about polar bears. Right now, the only image in my mind is the snarling dog trying to rip my fucking hand off. I kick him in the face, and one of his eyes is leaking and bulges funny, but now he's ripping and snapping at my legs. I see strings of meat and tendons spilling onto the floor. Something snaps, my legs stop kicking, and the dog is on my chest. My eyes close instinctively. Ivan's dog, he chose fight over flight. I see myself from above, with Ivan's dog on my chest, ripping at my throat. Then, finally, I see nothing at all.
For a genre that's so personal, it never ceases to amaze me how distanced horror can be. Good horror shows us how people react in the worst situations imaginable, and great horror, a lot of the time, shows us why they react that way, giving us a clear, unblinking look at what it's like to live in a world where the normal rules still apply, just not to you. The closing pages of I Am Legend, the Christopher Eccleston scene in The Others, and in particular, George's speech about what it's like the week before he changes in the original pilot of Being Human are all examples of this, placing the reader in the mind of a character who is neither a hero nor a villain, just a normal person, struggling to understand and survive an impossible situation. David Eric Nelson's Exit Exam, Section 3, Survival Skills, Question 7, does the same thing, placing you inside a very personal moment of horror with elegance, wit, and jet black humour. It's also our closing story for this first edition, so make sure you let the raven out when you leave, and we'll see you again soon for three more flash stories, all of which are true. Exit Exam, Section 3, Survival Skills, Question 7, by David Eric Nelson. 7A. You are a werewolf. You kill and eat people. You are a vicious animal. Even before the moon is full, you begin to feel a hunger, bristling and lively, which twists low into your gut, like a spring. It flexes and groans and grinds in the cradle of your hips. By the time the moon shines full and blue across the neat backyards of your neighbourhood, by then, the hunger has swollen full, a bubble of nothing that swallows you. You are one great, naked hunger. You're standing on your porch. A car swishes by through the light snow, and you're gone into the velvety, bracing night. Afterwards, you are sick. You wake up, curled in a ball at the back of your closet, cozied into a nest of your own shredded clothes. You're sticky with blood. It's under your fingernails and ground into the wrinkles of your palms and knuckles. It coats your face. It's tangy in your mouth. You are disgusted. You know that the you that courses through the yards and flower beds, the you that tears cats in half, the you that leaps through bay windows and sinks its teeth deep into the nape of old women's necks and young boys' thighs, you know that that you isn't the same you, the real you. You go to church. You volunteer at a soup kitchen 2 Sundays a month. You love your nieces, but there's another you. A you that's as foreign to the 27-day you as it is to everyone else in the world, and that you is a very, very bad thing. Question. Are you morally obligated to kill yourself? 7B. Okay, you're not a werewolf. Yet. You've never killed anyone. You've never eaten raw meat, not even oysters or sushi or a bug, not even an accident. But you can feel the brittle glass hunger turning low in your gut. You've felt it for 4 months now. It grows with the moon. In September, it was almost just a thirst, an itch at the back of your throat. October too. But in November it was so strong. By the end of the month, you found yourself staring long and hard at the cooler cases at the grocery store. You found yourself thinking strange thoughts, salivating as you stared at the ground beef, the sides of ribs, the thick steaks, the blood. Now it's December, and at night the hunger swells so large that sometimes it almost makes your eyes roll back. You stare fixedly out the window and wonder. You've got 8 steaks thawing in the sink. You have no plans to invite anyone over. You're not warming the broiler. You are very, very scared. You aren't so worried about this month, but January, February, March, spring, and summer, and fall, and next year, and the year after, and, well... Question. At what point are you morally obligated to kill yourself? 7C. You're not a werewolf. Werewolves aren't real. No one's a werewolf. But something's wrong now. Since August, maybe. Suddenly there is a brittle, glass sliver hunger. Well, not quite a hunger, but it growls like a hunger. It grinds deep in your gut. Or maybe a little further down than your gut. Deep and low. It's a low feeling. You've never been a man who leers, or even looks at women. You aren't that guy at all. Not to say you're, you know, funny or anything. You date and stuff. You like women. But you've been noticing girls recently. young girls noticing, and not in the nice way. Suddenly there is something sticky about them. A girl passes and your eyes are dragged to her and trail after her, following her legs, her arms, her. "This isn't you," you say. "You're not that guy. You're positively not that guy. But last week you were filling in for Terry Trumbull at the daycare down at the rec centre. You were sitting in the indoor playground, leaning against the wall and staring through the monkey bars and past the slide, out the big bay windows, watching the snow lazily tumble down out of the cotton batting sky. A little girl, knee socks, pleated skirt, Peter Pan collar, was playing on the slide, riding down, then sprinting around to the ladder, then down again, over and over and over and over. You don't know her, precisely. You're pretty sure you saw her take First Communion 2 Sundays back. Pretty sure. Down and around, down and around, down and around. You're looking out the window, but not looking out the window. Down and around, down and around, down, and she stumbles, comes down hard on her hands and knees. Her skirt flips up and there's a glimpse, a moment of, well, and she begins to cry. You jog up to her, asking if she's okay. She rolls over and cradles her knee and there is an angry, sticky rug burn. Oh, you say, that's not bad. You'll be fine. But she's still crying. She's still upset. And you kneel next to her and you put your hand on her shoulder. It's okay, you say. It's okay, sweetie. You lean forward. You lean deep because she's so small under you, in the shadow of your hulking shoulders. It's okay, see? I'll kiss it. And you plant your lips on the raw, salty, exposed skin. The skin under the skin. The deep skin. See? All better. You lean back and look at her. Her eyes are wide and red, and she's calm. She sniffles twice deeply and says, thank you, then runs off to the giant blocks. You stand stiffly and mince back towards the wall, and a shiver, like a pane of glass in a high wind, runs through you up and down your trunk from jaw to heel. A vicious cramp twists in your gut. Well, that's a lie. It's not so high as your gut, but you aren't admitting that to yourself, and it isn't precisely a cramp. Either. When you were a teenager, you had a name for that kind of cramp, but you refused to even allow the name to surface in your mind. The hint of the idea of the hunger that knots deep in your... You ask Jan Switz to keep her eyes double-peeled on account of the fact you need to visit the men's room, and then you pound out the door. You stagger into the hall, into the John, into the only stall. You sit on the can and you cry, uncontrollably. Inconsolably, your fist jammed against your teeth to prevent anyone from hearing your hysterics and to keep in whatever it is that is twisting and growing within you, whatever glass monster has burrowed in and now is burrowing out. But of course, you know that even that is a little bit of a lie, right? Nothing burrowed into you. This is you. This is what you are, and soon you'll be out in the world, pounding through the night like a slat-sided dog or a wolf in the brush, quietly moving along the groomed paths, waiting for little girls dawdling on their way to Grandma's house. Question: are you morally obligated to kill yourself?
Pseudopod relies on you to cover its costs, which include servers, hosting costs and author payments, but not, oddly, heating Pseudopod towers. It's always oddly warm here. Anyway, if you like these stories, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you will not regret it.
This is Ben Phillips, chief editor of Pseudopod, here with an exclusive offer from audible.com. Sign up today through this special offer using our URL, not Audible's main page. And you can choose a book from their selection of over 60,000 choices, download it right away, and keep it as a free gift even if you decide that Audible isn't for you. The URL to use, which we'll also link in our show notes, is audiblepodcast.com/pseudopod.
Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated, and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative License. And Pseudopod can see the bright light. It ain't heaven, son. It's just muzzle flare.